I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Thank you very much for coming. This is, the quasi-launch for my book, but it's also a chance for me to talk to Marina and Carl, who've inspired me in massive ways and keep on doing all the time. And it's wonderful doing it here. My sort of very minor sub-literary career is largely down to the LRB. So it always feels like coming home with all the kind of like vague hatred that comes with that as well. But a lot of love, a lot of love too. Parents. So we're going to talk about the roots of our current, I'll call it propaganda crisis, but the kind of like, I don't know, the cult of bullshittery, whatever's going on right now at Westminster as we speak, this kind of crisis that everyone's now aware of, but we all maybe struggle to name post-truth. I don't know. The roots of it, what we most hate about it, or maybe like about it, and obviously really clear step-by-step guide of how we emerge from it and return to, you know, an enlightenment democracy. I think with clear 10-point guides from all of us to be able to enact it, I think, like, you know, definitely within kind of Boris Johnson's term as Prime Minister. So, like, what, one more day before that blows up? We want to start off with the roots of the thing that we can't quite put our finger on. And we were talking downstairs, and there's technological roots, but there's also cultural roots. I mean, my first book was about Russia, where I saw kind of the end of an ideology, a politics of ideology, where, you know, communism's, for all its evils, was still trying to prove some sort of future of the world. It was all meant to be rational, even if it was kind of weird. And then in the 90s and 2000s, ideology gets thrown out the window in Russia. Democratic capitalism is also seen as a bit of a disappointment. And instead, basically, politics becomes pure performance, yeah? And Putin and his spin doctors tap into this very, very early. They realize, hold on, why don't we just blend politics and the reality show? And that would happen literally in Russia. You'd switch on the TV and there'd be like two sides debating, like mad right-wing people and mad left-wing people. And after a while, you realize they'd all been, you know, they're all kind of actually controlled by the Kremlin, and they'd been kind of cast as particularly ridiculous versions of their various ideologies, all to make Putin look good. By contrast, I'm simplifying massively, but that's kind of the essence of the thing. But Marina, at the same time, you were kind of, you know, in the early 2000s, you were already observing a kind of a shift towards the blending of reality show and politics here as well. And we're just talking downstairs, and there's a couple of moments you picked out, which I think are like critical to understanding where we are now.
I'm not sure about that. I didn't actually predict that the biggest reality star of that era on both sides of the Atlantic would become the president. But I did think it was getting quite bad. I remember thinking Simon Cowell was a really bad thing. And although when I was writing about it in my showbiz column, I was trying to sort of tell jokes, I do remember thinking, yeah, this is quite fucked up. And all the things he's into are quite wrong. But people loved it. His views on the elections were sought. Right, who would Cowell back for whatever election it was? And I remember Gordon Brown saying, I would like an X Factor politics. Do you still want one, Gordon? I think he probably regrets thinking that all these emotional stories and journeys and whatever were, you know, the future of politics. But Cal got himself got really into the idea. He was so drunk on his power at that point because he had the two top rating shows on both sides of the Atlantic. And he was saying things like, yeah, but they're doing it in China, Afghanistan, with X Factor Idol. We've given democracy to these countries. And again, I don't think that quite worked out. But I remember one time when he was sort of saying, I think that we should have a new show and it should be every Sunday evening. And you know what? People can ring and people can keep voting. We should have a referendum every Sunday evening. What do you think, guys? Who wants one of those? They wanted to have a red phone in the middle of the thing and they could ring Downing Street at the end of the programme.
Now, I remember talking to sort of people who exported TV formats to China and other places saying, if we can get the Chinese to vote during like X Factor, that'll teach them the values of democracy and that'll sort of inspire them to sort of democratic change.
It's going amazingly.
Yeah, I love that. Vote.
Yeah.
Carl, so that's the kind of, that's part of sort of the cultural kind of like flow down which we've travelled much further now. But you approach the same kind of like clusterfuck through the logic of technology and how technology took us there. And there's a weird relationship. Reality show, and TV is my own background, was kind of like the final stage of TV where everybody was gagging to sort of get into the screen and anybody could be a star. And then suddenly social media delivered that. It was like social media was the sort of the hidden latent promise of reality show TV. And how has the technology taken us further and further away from democracy as we knew it previously?
Yeah, well, kind of the moment I was kind of brought face to face with the clusterfuck, as you call it, was probably a couple of years ago when I was kind of invited. I was on a British Army base. You know, it was around the rolling green hills of Berkshire, and you kind of, you know, it's this kind of, it looks like your old school. It's kind of these kind of decrepit brick buildings and kind of outhouses and stuff like that. But in the kind of offices, there were people that were doing graphic design, and there was kind of posters on the wall saying things like behavioral change is our USP. If everyone is thinking the same, then nobody's thinking. I mean, it's kind of a weird mix of your old school and a tech giant. You know, there's lots of people doing data science and analytics. And I was kind of, what on earth is going on? And it kind of led me to kind of begin to follow this thread in how conflict and, in fact, war has completely changed, totally, utterly changed over the last kind of 5 or 6 years. It kind of began on 4chan with cats, weirdly enough. As all these people had gone on to 4chan.
Do you all know what 4chan is? 4chan is the dank corner of the internet where the neo-Nazis... Oh, you all go there, right? Okay,
These are 8chan people.
These are 8chan people. Oh, okay, yeah.
Discord. I mean, you know, far less notorious or even racist back in 2003, 2004. 4chan was kind of like, you know, a simmering home of online subcultures, quite lefty, really, quite anti-corporate. But they kind of noticed with horror as all the normies came onto the internet. And they decided, okay, if everyone's invading our internet... Well, we're going to invade offline life with the internet. And they began to kind of develop all the techniques which have become all too familiar with us now. They began doing sock puppet accounts. They tried to send Justin Bieber to North Korea by hacking the online poll. They made Moot Time Person Magazine of the Year. Moot was their leader. They started trolling Oprah Winfrey's blog to get her to warn that there were 9,000 paedophiles. There weren't 9,000 paedophiles. It was an in-joke from Dragon Ball Z. You know, they started doing swarm attacks. They basically began to pore over all these different things and work out how the internet could be used to influence people. And kind of, they never would have called this information warfare or probably anything other than the lols or maybe attention hacking. But then that turned into something for profit. And I think around 2005, 2006, we had this whole kind of shady illicit economy open up to do illicit influence. I met some of these people. I met them in Kosovo, fake news merchants, clickbait merchants, people in their early to mid-20s who have no idea what they're sending. One of them runs the largest portal for Native American information in the world. He has literally no idea what any of it actually means, but they can command. I mean, one of them could command, for instance, I think you could get his content into more eyeballs than the Sunday Times. The audiences they can attract, absolutely massive. So next it was for the profit. And the kind of like last part of this kind of long transition, I think. And if you look at militaries and what they actually write about why they exist and what they do, they've all gone through this, I think, momentous kind of moment over the last kind of 5 or 6 years where they've all basically gone through the same line of thinking. They've all said, We now live in the information age. Information is really central to society. How do we as militaries react to this? Well, information needs to become central also to war. And so, like, information's always been used in war, right? It's always been a tool of war. It's always been deception and lying has always been part of how war works. But somewhere along the line, this kind of conceptual gymnastic leap happened where information went from being a tool of war to being a theatre with which war is fought in. Like, it became a domain of war. You fought in information. You manoeuvred in information. You had to dominate the terrain of information. And that's the pieces we're picking up now. Every military around the world, liberal, democratic, autocratic alike, have all pivoted to fight in this new, you know, air, sea, land, space, information, and then maybe cognitive, to fight in these new domains.
One of the things I found so interesting in your book is the idea of war itself almost being post-war. You're saying it's almost like a sort of front for the actual war, which is information. It's just, you know, it's a way of the stories being allowed to compete, but so that there's some sort of scenario happening that they can compete over.
Yeah, because I mean, like, what you've just talked about, sort of like, you know, attention, influence, and sort of a philosophy of conflict is exactly what I would push onto my poor, unwitting, okay, no, cynical, attention-hungry reality show candidates when I made reality shows. That's exactly what I was getting them to do. And that's what we were told to do. We all read Aristotle very, very deeply when we made reality shows, and we knew that conflict was the essence of drama. But that's everything we do. And I remember when reality shows first started, just to pivot back to reality shows, I'll square the circle soon. Remember the first series of The Apprentice? It was actually very, very nice. And it was like people being quite nice to each other, the British Apprentice, and sort of genuinely competing with their different business ideas.
To try and get a job.
Yeah, they were taking it quite literally. And at one point, and Big Brother as well, they were quite like, they got on with each other at first and tried to sort of like, you know, help each other in the Big Brother house. And then kind of the producers, it must have been the producers, they made the decision to like, okay.
Just get them very drunk, make them fight the whole time. And one of the things I always was quite interested in actually, that in those conflicts, that the particular nature of reality television conflict was always, it was never really resolved, but someone would come in and say, well, you've got yours, you say that and you say that. And I would always be like, no, but that person is actually wrong. That is the wrong thing to have done, like stealing those beans in the Big Brother kitchen or whatever it was. But it would always just be sort of a very...
Stealing Crimea from Ukraine.
Beans. That was a wrong thing to do.
They're not relative things.
It was a wrong thing to do.
Absolute trust. There's no two sides here.
Yeah. But then they would just be sort of like, no, well, that's your story and that's your story. And it was all just essentially part of the drama.
That's very true. And coming back to information war, so in Russia, information war isn't just a series of techniques. It's sort of grown to a whole quasi-ideology. It started off with these kind of nutty academics who are also kind of former spies, and now it's adopted by the president, who's a former spy, and just generally the whole kind of media elites, where it's much more than technique. They're basically saying that the Soviet Union fell apart not because it had terrible ideas or terrible economics or bad political values, but because of information viruses, like planted by the West. It's a whole worldview that explains everything that happens out there as forms of manipulation. There are no values in this world. There are no political arguments, no facts. They're irrelevant as well. There's only different types of manipulation, different types of performance. All that matters is information dominance. It sees information purely instrumentalized, the way a reality show candidate does. It doesn't really matter what you say in a reality show. You've just got to get the attention or generate conflict. And same in information war, it really doesn't matter. The truth of your argument is absolutely irrelevant. Information is just instrumentalized for attention hacking effects. I mean, they're kind of like the reality show culture and information war are kind of like the entertainment and the military side of a very similar kind of like crisis where but facts don't matter anymore.
Well, it's a kind of weird melding, isn't it? You've got the kind of like, you've got the emotive, kind of raw, very human kind of like things which reality TV shows expose. And outrage is for sure the largest tool of the information warrior. I've spoken to people that have tried to do it, and like what they tell me is, we never actually try and change the mind of large groups of people. That's not what this is about. This is about making people angry about the things they already believe. And outrage activation is just, sadly, the easiest thing you can do using the internet. It's much, much easier to get you angry about something than it is to get you to change your mind. So you've got all of that, but then you've got this like really clinical world where information is like, it's treated like a vector. You know, it's almost like this is like Newtonian mathematics. People talk about like viral uplift. and they'll talk about like angles information can strike you, and they'll talk about change models and influence models, and these are things which more and more and more are being rendered actually into quantifications and measurements and A/B testing.
But hold on, can it? Because I spoke to a lot of these people, and I currently work at the London School of Economics, where like if you don't have a methodology, you're not allowed to enter the conversation. It's like, what's your methodology for measuring this? Is it qual or quant? But like, can you really measure information effects? I mean, it's bollocks, isn't it? Sorry, not everything at the LSE. Just that little question.
I think you can, and certainly, like, unlike us, Peter, if you're willing to resort to more illicit techniques. So there's a whole kind of like, you know, there's like a circle here, right? So if you're an information warrior, you kind of like, you know, you've got your public, you do research on them, you work out how they tick, you realise what they like and dislike, you get your change model, like why are they going to change, like how's their behaviour going to change, you then get your channels, how are we going to reach them. You then get your kind of like, you then exploit those channels. So you've got campaign activation. You then got measurements where you try and see whether the behavior is changing or not in the ways that you want. And then you kind of rinse and repeat. Now, like, how do you actually do that? Well, as academics or as researchers or even as journalists, actually quite difficult. But if you're willing to reach into the darker areas as information warriors are, well, I sit on your email. You know, I breach your computer. I breach your organizational systems as well. I bug your home. You know, and this is where the kind of like, you know, the covert world of intelligence and this world that we're used to inhabit, you know, of information and arguments and debate, they actually begin to weirdly meld, as so many things are in this world, into kind of like shadier, greyer versions of each other. So I think there is a lot you can do if you're willing to break the law and if you know more about computers and the people that you're seeking to target. Whether any of that actually really works is still an open question. And we don't know as researchers, we don't know what campaigns are more influential than others. I actually secretly believe that we often look at information warfare as a way of explaining things like the rise of national populism or Trump, actually that are due to a series of like profound social and political forces that have nothing to do with people being duped. So I think it's like we can sometimes use this actually a fig leaf for not understanding how society works and for kind of blaming Cambridge Analytica or blaming information warfare on things which are...
Too.
Yeah, and I kind of worry about the liberal left actually over-focusing sometimes on this kind of thing.
It's a form of conspiracism in itself, which is linked to the things it's supposed to be criticising.
Yeah. I think especially journalists like to write about information because we work in information, and therefore it's like we're writing about ourselves.
Well, it feels personal, doesn't
it? Yeah. But even if we don't take it as a kind of like a cause and effect thing, but as an expression of much deeper thing, I mean, see, there seems to be sort of a common malaise between an entertainment culture where information is just used for the sake of, you know, information dominance and attention grabbing and ratings, but not because of its substance, and conflict for the sake of conflict. You obviously have a politics that's completely blended with that to the point where a reality show Muppet is president. And then you have, in the world of war as well, moving away from kind of war as we've thought about it before to essentially a massive reality show. I go to Ukraine in this book quite a lot, and I go to the front lines. And it's a very weird war in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine. Neither side want this territory. Again, I'm kind of like, you know, I'm simplifying, but neither one wants it. Both need it only so far that they can tell a story to their own audience. So the Ukrainians need it to show that if you were going to be a separatist, things are going to be unpleasant. And they just need enough video material to tell that story. The Russians need to tell the story, if you want democracy, you end up with war and bloodiness. You know, their big thing is breaking down the narrative of 1989. Like, pro-democracy protests equals bloodshed. That's what they've got to show. And both sides are kind of like using the same material and then cutting it in different ways to their respective audiences. Obviously, in my mind, being a Ukrainian who's lived in Russia, there's only one side to blame in this conflict, but still the mechanics of the information conflict are very, very interesting. But that's exactly what happens when, you know, you have like an interview between some sort of like Ben Shapiro, some alt-right guy, goes on TV, has some sort of experience, then immediately each side...
I saw this interview that Farage did on Andrew Marr about, I don't know, sort of a couple of months ago, maybe, or 3 months ago. And almost within... he just did it. Everyone sort of said, oh, Marr got the better of him. I mean, whatever that means. Because in 15 minutes, Farage's side had cut it totally so you don't even see Marr anymore on the clips. And all those clips go out. And there he is against the BBC background, just literally getting his talking points away. And it says Farage, you know, owns...
Owns. This owned genre drives me crazy. I hate it. Yeah,
it just says Farage owns Andrew Marr. You were talking about owns, and it made me laugh that it's just a whole... Everybody has said to... I mean, even the interview that Ben Shapiro walked out admitting to Andrew Neil that he wasn't prepared. I've seen that described as actually he's owned it, and actually this is a win for Ben Shapiro. And I slightly wonder now whether we need to think this kind of supposedly gladiatorial thing where some real hotshot interview like methodically takes these people apart one by one, because this is what happened with Steve Bannon sitting down at the border in something, and I just thought this is, he's been totally legitimized by it getting onto the BBC. Why? He's not even, what's he, why is he on? He's just a grifter now. He's not, if he's in the White House, fine. I mean, maybe you interview him, but he's not. And I just, the way he used that interview and that to legitimize himself, I think we have to be really careful. It's not the same as in the old days when people used to do this. And I do think, having been someone who was more of an absolutist on free speech, I do think actually some people, why are they on? They don't need to be on, and they certainly don't need to be on as much as they are. And
so censorship.
No, I'm not. But I don't think you have to. I'm listening to young people more who are saying that, you know, why do we have to have these people here? There's a line in The Simpsons where Bart Simpson's doing something, and he's quite rude to this guy, and he goes, "Young man, in my day, we didn't talk to whatever." And Bart says, "Yeah, well, this is my day, and we do." And I quite think, you know, these young people, who many of whom have been chased down the street, having racist things screamed at them, it's always some middle-aged white guy who's going, "Yeah, I just think we should have every view." And I think maybe listen to people who have been. I'm not totally sure that sunlight is the best disinfectant. Nick Griffin did brilliantly from the Question Time when he went on it. Everyone said, "Have him on, he'll be a moron and he'll, you know, make a fool of himself." And he did. But you know what? BNP recruitment went up. Now they've fallen away, but maybe they've been absorbed into other areas of our politics.
So I think we've kind of defined the crisis, and now we're moving towards what do we do about it.
There's a missing jigsaw piece.
Oh, no.
Can you imagine? we have spent 20 minutes talking about all of this, and no one has blamed the tech giants for anything.
Going to say, I had a whole line ready, but then you were so good.
They like the outrage.
Well, it's as if Simon Cowell took his brain and put it into Mark Zuckerberg's. Or maybe Mark Zuckerberg was actually, maybe this is what happened. Zuckerberg just grew up watching X Factor. I was like, okay, and at some subliminal level, outrage, attention seeking, good. Because it's as if the social media giants have programmed their algorithms with Simon Cowell logic, or with Gordon Brown logic, I don't know. But sort of Gordon Brown and Simon Cowell, because they're both political and entertainment. It's bizarre, the whole thing just basically provokes a behavior which is not about truth or debate or reasonableness, but which is about attention seeking, outrage, and polarization. And it's almost as if the technology is now summoning up these politicians, you know. The politicians are like, "Oh, that's what I've got to do. Okay, I'll do that as well."
They're being yielded by the algorithm.
Salvini may have been a nice guy, but then he just saw, well, I've got to do this, this is the game. And he's transformed into a monster.
And all of that, I think, implies why platform engineering, the actual underlying piping which runs these platforms, is one of the most important battlegrounds which we have today. It changes everything. And in it, it is essentially an expression of implicit philosophy about what people should see. There are values baked into all of those platforms, and human rights and goods and bads and values are fought and won and lost and die on that hill now. And yet it's nowhere near politicized enough. It's nowhere near visible enough. Not enough people understand how they work. Politicians aren't asking the right questions about it. And that really gets under my skin, because, like, you know, there is nothing is enshrining your rights, maybe anywhere, but certainly online, more than a protocol which very few people have heard of called TCP/IP. That protocol, TCP/IP runs the internet. That is a basic protocol which runs the internet. And baked in there is a particular vision for how the internet should work. Right? And now that is one of many different parts of the internet which is now coming under attack by autocracies. And like these are now the enshriners of all the rights which we enjoy, actually, which are so ubiquitous and fundamental to all of us that we don't even see them and know they're there. Like, one other quick example, YouTube. Like, we focus on Facebook so much. We all hate Facebook, Zuckerberg's so terrible, and Twitter, because, like, journalists are on Twitter a lot, and so are politicians. YouTube is an absolute hornet's nest of conspiracy theorism and alt-right garbage. It is the home of the owned genre. It is nowhere near as protected as the other platforms. And the reason for this is that in 2015, YouTube had something called the Gangnam-style problem. So all of their algorithms basically recommended more popular content. So if you like this, well, more people like that. And basically everyone eventually, if you clicked on these recommender links enough, ended up at Gangnam style. by Psy.
Right? Now we find who's really to blame.
Right, so that was a Gangnam, that was a Gangnam Style problem. So they made this momentous decision in 2015 that they were going to re-architect their algorithms. And instead, what they tried to do is they said, well, people are likely to be on our platform if we actually push them to more diverse content, which is similar to the content that they've already seen. And this just became a nightmare. So you would begin by looking at weight loss videos, and you'd end up with crazy pills, you know, or end up with like radical pro-ana kind of weight loss stuff. Or you begin by looking at some reasonably centrist alt-right politician and end up with Shapiro and then more and then more and then the alt-right and the Nazis. And basically these algorithms like pushed so much attention away from mainstream centrist stuff and gave this just unbelievable, unprecedented amount of airtime to a series of fringe ideas, which were by definition, and the algorithms recognised them to be, more fringe and more and kind of further away from the mainstream than the things that people were already seeing.
So basically and, exactly what I was doing when I was producing reality shows, like more extremes, guys, more extremes, we need more conflict.
And this went, you know, and this went under the radar, right? Because like 2015, 2016, like I guess like the main, we all knew about YouTube, but we hadn't quite realised that this was like television for everyone under the age of 30, right?
Yeah.
So like politicians weren't really looking at it. We weren't really kind of like, people in power weren't subjecting these things to the kind of scrutiny which already their kind of centrality in society demanded that it should have. And now we are just reaping the benefits, or rather the sorrows of this. This is one of, that's genuinely, I don't like to kind of over privilege technology, but that algorithmic shift is one of the reasons we've seen the far right rise around the world, genuinely.
So we've got 10 minutes left to do solutions. Let's do small steps. The Russian dissidents, who I talk a lot about in my book as well, skillfully trying to plug my book during this conversation, they talk something about the theory of the small steps. So, like, what are the small steps we can take in order to start dealing with this? Actually, I want to start something very small. Marina, when you write about this world, this kind of like, and you write about it all the time, and all of us read you, and it's kind of like, it's become a way for us to sort of like, you know, get through the day. But...
That's true. But thank you for being so kind.
No, that is well, certainly true for me, maybe a few other people. How do you square the circle? Because you're writing about these attention-grabbing people who don't care about the truth. How do you write about them while not playing into their games? Because that's a crisis all journalists face all the time. And how do you satirise people who are, you know, self-satirising sometimes?
It's definitely harder for sort of long-term satirical projects. I mean, it's very hard, I think, to imagine sort of satirical dramas at the moment because it's so fast moving that it takes a long time, obviously, as you know, to get a TV show into production and things like that. It takes a long time. Whereas someone like John Oliver, I think, does it very well in the United States. You know, he does it once a week and they've obviously got a lot of people working on that show and he goes down into, it's still very funny, but he goes down into one issue. I found it has been, God, I mean, I don't really know what to say about my nonsense, but it helps if you're doing it sort of, you know, it's disposable what I'm doing. It's not supposed to be hanging around for years or be, it's supposed to be, it is changing so quickly. I think it is good to try and write something at the time of it happening. Although I have to say for me that I have been quite depressed by the turn of events over the last few years. And it has been quite satisfying just on a very personal level to try and think of some jokes about it. It does slightly kind of exercise it for me. I mean, it's a form of therapy in some way, I suppose. But that's not really very helpful for anyone else.
But your work is actually full of, like, you know, it's actually quite morally serious. There's this very powerful column you did the other day. Yes, I think so. But so is John Oliver's, and maybe satire always is. But you had this very powerful column the other day about Prince Andrew, and really with one of the most powerful kind of indictments of, you know, why sort of, you know, 50-year-old men should not really, you know, hang around with vulnerable young women. You know, he's got kids himself. I mean, doesn't he understand that this is someone else's child?
Well, yes. Yes, I think that one, I do try to keep the anger out. I very rarely use an angry, there was an angry tone in that column, but one of the things I've always thought in writing is that to really keep the angry tone out and to use it so sparingly. And then when you do use it, it has got more effect. And also I think people just, there are some columnists perhaps who are more shouty, but actually you do switch off because it's every time they're ever doing it, they're across all the time. And I actually think that you kind of need to use it sparingly. I always thought that even when I was doing the diary column many, many years ago, I always thought that sort of fake sympathy was much more effective as when you're taking the piss out of politicians. Fake sympathy or sort of exaggerated politeness was much more effective and much more cutting than sort of something more, I don't know, head on. And I do try and think of, I do think jokes are quite effective ways of doing things. That, so I try to do it. And I also just think we need jokes. Fucking hell, it's so depressing. So I try and tell jokes about a quite a depressing time.
If you're writing now, as opposed to sort of like the 1990s or the 1800s or the 1700s, I mean, you've probably never done this thought exercise, but is there something specific about doing sort of political and social satire now? Is there a difference about doing it now?
I don't know. I always try now. I wasn't really allowed to write about politics until I was about 40 in The Guardian. Is this being recorded? But I definitely think that I think that people like to talk about it. I always do lots of analogies for things that people might actually like, e.g., I don't know, sport, movies, television, just pop songs, anything other than just discussing Westminster in terms of itself, which I find very... I don't think anybody normal just thinks of things like that. Or anyway, they'd much rather think about it surely in terms of a film they like or football or something, other than this kind of relentless... It seems ever tighter focused in this tiny way of talking about things. So I've tried to do it like that. So I don't know whether people did that. I think people trying to sort of satirize in those eras looked out to find common ground with actually the experience of people's lives, because it's just not the experience of people's lives.
So that's very interesting, because in the interviews that I did for the book, didn't actually go into the book, but I talked a lot to sort of old Soviet dissidents and conceptual artists from that period. And they said their main task was their language and sort of social and political language had been eaten up so deeply by the Soviet state. They were constantly looking for new ways to talk about reality and to talk about politics. So they used the language of ballet, the language of religion, anything not
yeah, I
to
really
use.
Get, I really get
language
that.
Language has been consumed.
Yeah, anything other than talking about it in political terms. I always wanted to write about politics in the way I do now and talk about it in other ways, not in a conventional way of discussing it, because I just felt that it was a turn off and it just wasn't really relevant, and also it's become
ridiculous because they've made a nonsense out of it.
Yes, and they have stripped words, and actually even under Tony Blair there were so many words. I mean, the ideas of words like taking responsibility and all these kind of phrases that were completely denuded of meaning. So I suppose you have to find other ways of doing it.
Carl, let's regulate. Let's get regulatory. It's great. I, like you, have been pulled into sort of discussions in Whitehall about how to regulate. It's going to happen, but it strikes me there's a way to regulate this well, and there's a way to regulate this which will make it even worse. And we're obviously choosing the latter of that of that sort of decision tree.
Of course. When would we ever not?
Britain especially is going to take some regulatory steps around the internet.
Yeah.
How can it be done optimally, and how will it go wrong?
A discussion around regulation. Yeah.
We're going to make this fun, though. Yeah. We're about to go into questions for the hall. Let's just tease something.
All right.
It is a big debate in Whitehall at the moment. I mean, outside, I know everything's Brexit. Actually, there's a very big discussion about this.
Yeah, there is. All right. Here's my two cents. The solutions you'll hear are digital literacy training.
I'm going to buy a roll.
That won't work. At
it will
all.
In the long term.
It won't even work in the long term. Oh, right. How do you train people to find, to detect something which is constantly changing and deliberately hidden?
I think actually digital literacy makes things worse. It makes people super cynical about everything. And our problem is a lack of trust. It's just like, if you tell people don't believe anything on the internet, then, you know, well, we have that with deepfakes already, don't we?
Yeah.
We have politicians saying, oh, don't believe that stuff about me and the prostitutes. It's just a deepfake. Yeah. Don't trust anything out there.
Yeah. But it's woolly and it's uncontroversial and it doesn't kind of like affect any of the basic balances that we've got, and everyone wants to empower young people especially. So, you know, it's one that's always trotted out, and I'm sure the tech giants are going to kind of bang a couple of million into it every couple of years, and it won't make the blindest bit of difference. So the first thing to do is just to get rid of the idea that, like, digital literacy generally and other stuff is great. For information warfare, it just isn't. It's unhelpful that we even think it's a solution. In a nutshell, like, what I would do, I would criminalise some bits of it, to be honest. I'm about to sound quite illiberal for a centre-left think tanker, all right? Just sorry, but this is genuinely what I believe. I would criminalise some bits of it. I just don't think it's okay to, like, for instance, share, like, voter suppression information targeting black communities in the States immediately before an election. I just don't think you can do that. I think that we have to refresh the Espionage Act. Like, I think it actually just shouldn't be legal, some of the stuff that's happening. So I would criminalise it. I would regulate, but I wouldn't regulate content. Like, I just don't see how we can do this. Like, there's so many examples of parts of information warfare which have nothing to do with lying to people, as I already said. It's got to do with, like, making you angry by simply selecting some facts over other facts. You can build this grotesque view of the world simply by making some facts more visible than others. And there's nothing we can do around the content, I think, to be able to legislate against that. So I would make the platforms less frictionless. They've all been optimized to grow. That's what social media platforms want to do. And that means joining them and doing stuff on them and following people on them is made as easy as possible. Great for the platforms, probably bad for societies that are now based on those platforms in many ways. So I would regulate into the engineering, those pipes, I said, those invisible pipes that I've already whinged to all about are being so important. I would see what we can do in terms of, like, international treaties and all the deterrence architectures that we've got. We have to make this stuff, like, more costly and riskier for the people that do it. I would, for instance, like, do no-fly lists. Like, it's worked quite well, actually, for Chinese theft of American international property. You put them, you name and shame them. Like, you sit on their servers. Like, and then you reveal who they are, and you say, you're never coming to the United States or Europe ever again. I hope you can do your Christmas shopping in Russia. You know, and this, I think this kind of stuff, we could do a lot more of all that kind of stuff. Sorry, that sounds really illiberal. And in a sense, like, I'm actually, in this of many areas, I'm not... Like, I don't think that the fact-checking and the civic society communities and in general, like, I don't think they're going to win by themselves. Yeah. Like, there has to be heavier intervention by liberal democratic governments. There has to be to change the calculus that autocracies make when they think about whether to do this. That's hard power, I'm afraid, as well as soft power. And we're not using enough of the hard power that we actually still have in order to try and protect ourselves.
But very quickly, what about domestically, though? I mean, that's the transnational stuff. But what about... So Marina Warner, editor at the LIB, said there's one thing that needs to be changed. It's the iconography of Facebook. Get rid of likes and emoticons and all that stuff. That really pushes you towards an emotional logic that takes you away from reasoned debates and genuine interaction. I mean, is it... Okay, she was being provocative, but is it like that as well? That we need to actually have entry into the algorithm so that we have some sort of public oversight about the kind of behaviours they're provoking in society?
I mean, look, if we want to reach down to the most profound solution of all, we have to make online life much less like a game. Like, what has basically happened is that these platforms have created games out of things which answer our basic existential questions. You know, what does it mean to be successful? How can we be popular? You know, how can we mean something? How can we matter to other people? These are questions which we always, human beings, carry with us all the way through our lives. And now, like, in their different ways, the technology platforms have answered them for us by presenting games which we now just furiously try and win. Like, we don't ever ask ourselves what these games are or what they do to us or whether we want to play. We just furiously try and win. In so many different areas of social life. So if we really want to get rid of this, I would get rid of all the metrics. Get rid of all the follow accounts. Get rid of all the retweet counts. Get rid of all the ways in which we can just scurry after the most number of kind of retweets or Instagram posts or Facebook likes. You know, to get rid of all of that. You know, there are ways of using the internet to connect us genuinely with one another without making us these kind of frenzied, game-winning, you know, people that changes all of us. And actually, by the way, changes our relationships with one another as well. Because suddenly we become players in the game rather than citizens with each other, and the game, of course, can itself be gamed and gamified, and that's kind of what I think is happening. So if you really want it, like, you can reach deep down and completely rewrite. I mean, I want to be optimistic in my kind of final word before questions, which is, like, the good news here, folks, really, is that the internet can be redesigned. Digital technologies were designed once, and they can be redesigned now. Like, we have never had the amount of capacity as we do right now to actually, like explicitly design the worlds in which we live in. So we can do it. We can actually design this world to be much more humane and much more resilient to things like information warfare. But there are a lot of these obsessive addictions, like playing these games, which we've got to wean ourselves off of first, culturally, if we've ever got hope of doing that.
I think I did promise that I would take us from a journey from reality shows and Simon Cowell through to solutions. I think that was a very, very powerful speech. I started clapping a couple of times. As coherent, a kind of a solutions offer as I've ever heard. We have a few minutes for questions because we've got around 15 minutes. No. I think this was the original plan. You just all stunned in admiration for that speech. Just like, everyone's like, oh my God, it can change. It can be different. There's a question over here.
Hi, hello. Thank you so much for such an amazing introduction, and I'm sure everyone is so fascinated about your book and intrigued. My question to Peter Pomerantsev about your statement that there is a possibility, or you presume that neither Ukraine or Russia are interested in returning Donbass. Did you make this conclusion based on the analyzing information online or any other предпосылки? And also, when you said returning the territory doesn't need to be returned because it is Ukrainian under the international law. What did you mean by that, returning the mind of the people who left there, who are under the Russian occupation, or returning the mind of the perhaps Russian people who are in Russia and supporting Crimean annexation and military intervention in Donbass?
Which will take a few, because that's a I'll definitely answer that.
First, thanks very much for the brilliant presentations. Two four-word questions, which might be the same question. Is there any hope, and where will this end?
Okay, hope.
And I was just wondering, so a question for all of you. So Marina mentioned this issue about things that are objectively wrong and objectively right, I think, in the context of stealing chickpeas.
And baked beans.
Baked beans, sorry.
You always get a highbrow argument on me, always.
And so this is something that's been, I find, really difficult. Sorry to bring up the Brexit word, which I know you haven't really talked about, but that's something that seems to me to be objectively wrong, but I see very intelligent people who I admire saying that it's a good thing. And I see that with so many other things at the moment as well, just in small scales, like in my employment and things like that, where things that seem objectively bad are sort of presented as something good. And I just struggle to see where you find now the objective truth. You know, everything is biased, The Guardian is biased, The Telegraph is biased, everyone is giving their own views. So I'd be really interested to hear your views on that. Thank you.
How has your social media use changed from what you've learned?
Not at all. Problem. It's like smoking. Oh, it's killing me. It's dreadful.
It's true. Yeah.
Maureen, do you want to tackle the simple question of bias?
Yes. There's always, stories have always competed, and that I think that, you know, that's something that has always been the case. And actually, even with the Brexit vote, which obviously some people feel one thing and some people feel another thing, you know, and you can say, but you're voting against your economic interests. Lots of people vote against their economic interests for lots of different reasons. You might actually believe in better redistribution of wealth, and you might vote for a left-wing party that promises to do that. That is essentially against your own economic interests, but you'll still do it. There are various competing things. I worry more when things, as I say, things have been sort of, I don't know, I saw this deepfake thing that I was talking about earlier it was such an amazing deepfake thing that they can do within 8 seconds. They can change something so it looks like it's completely realistic. And I thought, how long before someone like Trump just starts saying, no, I never said that, that didn't happen, even though it actually, I would have classed that as a completely objective piece of truth. I think that's coming really soon. So I think that side of things is getting worse. And I think people will literally just say, people will say, black is white enough. I mean, but to some extent, they've always done that. They've always been competing narratives about all sorts of things. And that I don't think is new. I think the way in which it can happen now with technology is obviously something that we can't understand. And the way that can just be disseminated so quickly is a problem. Again, you understand more about how to regulate this stuff than me, but I think that is something that needs to happen. I'm not sure fact-checking, though, it's a very low-level solution to the problem.
So what's happened with bias? There was always, so in the book, still plugging away, I talked to some BBC executives, and I contrast the BBC of the late 20th century and now. There was always accusations of bias at the BBC in the 1980s. Go back and look at the scandals, how Seamus Milne's dad was sacked, maybe unfairly, by Margaret Thatcher's proxies, and where you now have to suffer for that today. Parents. What's changed now is, back then there was still an idea that objectivity was possible. You're being biased, but there is an objectivity out there. What's different now is that there's an assault on the very kind of ideals of public service broadcasting on impartiality, balance, objectivity, fairness. one of the heads of the Russian propaganda industry, Dmitry Kisilov, is out there saying objectivity is a myth imposed upon us, which is exactly the sort of argument that Newt Gingrich gives, that Sean Hannity, the main attack dog on Fox, that's a different kind of argument. They're saying, not just you're biased, fair enough, that we can get to objectivity together, we can enter into a discussion. They're saying, no, it doesn't exist at all. And that is a much, much more dangerous place to be in.
Alternative facts.
Just, yeah, but just the agreement is a priori impossible. And that's very, very hard to work with. There's a question about hopes and ends, and where does this end? Is there hope?
All right, thanks. That's the easy ones to deal with. All right, I'm going to be really optimistic. So I just come back from Thailand. I forgot this is being recorded. All right, I came back from Taiwan, and we're doing a BBC program on the digital Democrats there. I will try and be as unspecific as possible to try and not get myself in trouble. But
is this about V Taiwan?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I've read about that. So if I know about it, like, it's out there.
No, no, V Taiwan's not a secret. Yeah. Like, all right, so they too realised that their society was being polarised and in fact ripped apart by technology, and then they did something about it. So they got into power, these civic hackers. One civic hacker became the digital minister, and then she designed with others this kind of whole new process for doing politics. And at the heart of it is a platform where you have online debate, where people from different viewpoints come together, but it looks absolutely nothing. In fact, it's actually deliberately the opposite of Facebook or Twitter. Rather than you can't reply, you can't troll, but probably the most important aspect of this is that rather than just showing you the people surround you, it shows you the whole debate, shows you where you sit in this whole debate, and then the statements it surfaces are the ones which are most in common, most consensual across all the different parts of the debate. So it basically gamifies consensus finding. And what it finds is that when you re-engineer online debate to basically about finding consensus rather than about surfacing division, you actually find that on almost every issue, there might be like four or five like points which like people are bitterly divided on. And normally that's what actually the debate is about. But really there are 20 or 30 which people actually hold in common with one another, and they usually provide a solid enough ground for you to actually just move forwards. So in a way, they don't try and make you kind of like reconcile your most profound beliefs with someone that has another series of different and opposite profound beliefs. They kind of just like sidestep it and say, okay, well, what do you hold in common with each other? And like then they actually turn that into law. They've turned around 20 or 30 pieces of regulation and law now through this process. And they're going to now roll out so that I think all pieces of regulation and will go through a kind of V-Taiwan inspired process. So what does that tell us? I think it tells us that the nature of the places where we have these debates are as important as any of the debates that we actually have. And our future, really, I think, will depend on whether we kind of politicise now the right things. If we don't politicise things like the plumbing underneath these platforms, the kind of things that made visible or not, the ways in which we then are shown or not shown what other people think which may be similar or different to us. If we don't politicise these things, we don't turn them into active questions, and we don't kind of like say like, okay, well, there's different ways in which we can do politics, and we kind of force power to kind of interact with these and begin experiments around it, then I think we're going to go down a pretty dark path, because I don't think there are incentives for the tech giants to do this by themselves. But if we can, like if we do like kind of pivot as Taiwan has done and shown that it's possible, then I think actually the internet can do the things that we always hoped it would do, which is kind of actually bring people closer together and actually engage those more people who wouldn't be involved in politics in politics. So for me, like, yes, there's hope, and it ends with this question of, like, are we going to actually kind of politicise and think about and be activists around the right kinds of things? And the protocols and the platform engineering, things like that, I think, the things that are currently kind of lurking in the dark are things which, if they become open political questions, I think actually can be massively, massively improved for us all.
Very quick question about Russia. I mean, about Ukraine, sorry, and the war in East Ukraine. I mean, there's a big part about that in my book. So that's probably the best way to engage with there. But sort of my evidence base for making the statement that the information component of the war is more important than territorial gains is based on interviews with soldiers, military theorists, and people on the ground. Not that much Russian, but I think the fact that Russia clearly, you know, doesn't want to, you know, it wants to proxy control the territory, but hasn't bothered to, invade and annex like Crimea is
sure,
evidence from there.
Ukrainian side, you said it's literally equal both sides to not to be interested in
No, okay, I'm sorry. I've been in a context where I'm speaking very fast in a discussion. Let me clarify that, and I'm sorry if that was unclear. All I meant was that for the soldiers on the ground, for the military tactics on the ground, we're in a very strange conflict where the informational effect has become more important than territorial gains. Yeah. So the informational, that's not just happening in Ukraine. That's virtually all contemporary war is like this. This is just a new way of thinking about conflict. But also that is also expressed in the details of military tactics on the ground and about the amount of care and focus that would be taken if the aim was to retake territories in the short term. You'd have a different military approach there.
It's going to the restaurant for the Instagram posts.
Well, I wouldn't put it as brutally as that. I mean, I certainly do not want to claim any kind of equality in these two sides. One side has invaded, the other side is defending itself. So there's definitely no kind of moral equality or equality in law. I'm just talking about what it shows us about contemporary war and the way information has become more, often more important than what's going on the ground. And what's going on the ground has become, its main aim has become the informational effect. And that's slightly new. A couple more last questions?
Thank you. I thank you for so much in this talk. And Peter, I just wanted to say I read your book over the summer. It's a great cover, by the way, The Unicorn. And I found myself underlining all sorts of things. But the passage I wanted to ask you about was you talk a lot about conspiracy theories, how they've been weaponized. I think it goes to, you know, it seems that one of the ways we generate outrage is politically through conspiracy theories, and they increasingly kind of organize our political identities too. Could you speak a bit about that?
Okay, conspiracy theories. We like those.
And linked to that, what's your secret conspiracy theory that you really wish was true to all three? So maybe that's the last one.
I think the idea that Simon Cowell actually controls Facebook is just a great one. We should start pushing out.
Final one. I want Carl perhaps to say how the best thing it seems to me that we could do to recover the situation would be to, how could you enable Bon Marina's columns not just be read by a small number of Guardian readers, but to get out wide?
Small number, indeed.
If those columns could be got out to the sort of 50 or 60 million Brits, then things would certainly change.
Oh my God, is it that bad? Am I the answer? Right, we need to leave here and go to the shelters.
How can you alter the internet to make that kind of thing possible?
Yakov, how can you do that?
Let me go viral.
I think if Marina generated like more outrage and like, you know, then it could work, you know, just more hate.
Come up with some ideas for me in a minute when we're talking.
Yeah. Any favourite conspiracy theories or how do you see
my father-in-law really believed that Jimi Hendrix was killed by the CIA, and I would not rule that out at all. He recently died, but I want to carry on that flame for him, so I'm just going to put it out there. If I'm asked about a conspiracy theory, I'm going to put it out there. Hendrix? Drugs? I don't think so. He was getting too powerful. Okay. He would always be telling me a story with a massive joint. So that was one of his theories.
Was he spreading communism through his guitar music? And, you know, it kind of needs several layers of conspiracy theories for that to happen.
Yeah, but it's a civil rights. There's a whole load of stuff. Listen, okay, I can get onto this with you later, but I'm just putting that one out there. That's my first. I just want to keep that one alive.
I don't know. Conspiracy theories have often kind of replaced ideologies, especially for a type of leader that doesn't have a strong ideological basis, like, you know, we have one in the US, and they're all over the world, really. Conspiracies are, you know, it's a very pleasant worldview. You know, in a world of chaos, you have your big explanation. But the more insidious bit is if you live in a world of conspiracies where you can never get to the truth, then the little guy can't do anything. Then democratic change is impossible. That's why Putin's regime is so sort of fond of conspiracy theories as their main kind of idiom, really. And then you need a big, strong leader to protect you in this dark world where you can never understand anything. So I think that they're quite effective that way. They're both pleasurable, but also they kind of like, you know, they limit action and they make action seem hopeless. In conspiracy theory research, like everybody has their own conspiracy theories, even like liberal, enlightened people who were, you know, who write for like, you know, left-wing think tanks and liberal newspapers, or the other way around, I don't know anymore. Even they have their own pet conspiracies. Yeah. I think that's it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.